Everybody, J.J. Cooper, Jacob Brunner, Baseball America College Podcast. We are back. Jacob is back home, no longer in Omaha, slightly more rested, more resting, hopefully still to come. But great to see you, Jacob. And what we are talking about today is the summer season of college baseball, which, to be honest, starts well before the end of the previous season. We were talking about this. We were writing about this while the season was still going on, but now we are officially in the off season. Jacob, great to see you. And I'll just kind of kick it over to you. I know that there are people who fully explain it, but for those who don't, and for those who need a refresher, explain what's going on. So we have the portal, as we're recording this on July 30th, we have the portal, the door, the gate is swinging closed for most people. If you're going to put yourself on the portal, you better do it soon, with some exceptions. But there's also a lot of other things going on with NCAA and eligibility. What, you know, kind of just lay it out for everybody.
Let's start with the end of the portal. Let's break that down because that's going to be the most relevant calendar marker that we're going to hit here for everybody that's listening to this. The way that the portal ends is more of a soft closure than it is a full closure. There's no such thing as no transfer portal anymore in college sports. June 30th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern time is done. Or sorry, actually, I believe it's 11:59 p.m. local time, depending on where you are. That's what
you could race. You could race if you from somehow you could race to, you know, if you're close to the a time zone change, you could race to the next time zone.
If you, it's actually, it's more if you can move your school's physical location before the time that 11:59 hits, then you're in good shape. Much tougher to do. For the most part, that will be the closure of the portal for the vast majority of players. 90% of players will be frozen out of entering the transfer portal starting tonight, tonight being June 30th. If you have graduated from your university, you're a grad student, and this is an academic tag, just to be clear, you can enter the portal whenever you want. Tomorrow, in a month from now, in 2 months from now, the portal is constantly open for graduate transfers.
There's a logic to that. Which is, this is still in some ways an academic enterprise. And as a grad student, you should be able to go somewhere else to work on your grad studies, right?
There you go. It's the last remnant, if you will, of you know, student athleticism. If your coach leaves your school, whenever it happens, last year we saw Tony Vitello leave in the middle of college football season, in the middle of fall ball. The transfer portal is open for a limited window for those players on those teams that lose their coach. More often than not, the further we get away from the season, the closer we get to fall ball, if we get into fall ball, the rate which transfers will occur due to a coaching change goes down dramatically for two reasons. One, because for most schools, it's really hard for you to get admitted at that point in the year. And two, rosters for the most part are already finalized. So there isn't exactly a lot of space for you if you're going to enter in the portal after a late coaching change. There's also kind of a weird, tricky balance of trying to get you into school if you do find a roster spot. And in some cases, like in the SEC, you're just completely ineligible to play if you transfer after a certain time. So those are the rough closure rules. Let's talk about what the portal is. The portal has been open for the last month. It opened on June 1st. During that period, total free-for-all. If you play college sports and you have eligibility left, even in some cases, if you are fighting for more eligibility and you don't yet have it, you are eligible to enter the transfer portal. You can go wherever you please. You can transfer as many times as you'd like. So that's the state of affairs as far as the transfer portal goes. You mentioned there's more. You mentioned that there is an eligibility change. There is probably an eligibility change. There's a lot of legal jargon that is above my pay grade to figure out, but the trajectory for college sports right now is that athletes will be adopting an age-based eligibility system where, for the most part, athletes will be afforded the opportunity to play 5 years over five seasons. So you get another year of eligibility. You could be a grad student. There's no more such thing as a red shirt that goes out the window, and you just have 5 years to play five. So those are the big changes. Those are the big landmark things that are happening around college sports around this time of year. And yeah, we need to keep an eye on, continue to keep an eye on where the eligibility thing trends.
I think that this last point you made, which is, we should say, basically the legalese of it is that the NCAA has indicated their intent to adopt, but it has to go through the full NCAA legislative process and approvals and all that to be an officially enacted revision to the rules. But there is every indication is that's where it's headed. Obviously, there are already talks of potentially there being lawsuits from people who are from players who may lose out under that of, you know, well, but that would be individual.
Let me interrupt you real quick. It is adopted. We're past the point of adoption. The NCAA has adopted this. So you have 5 years of eligibility after your 19th birthday to play college sports. That's done. The question is, just to be clear, when I say that it's not finished yet and there's legal things that are happening, there are already lawsuits that are coming into play that stand to potentially disrupt this. Do I think that's what's going to happen? No, that's why I said the direction of this appears to be settled. We are going to have an age-based eligibility system that affords athletes the opportunity to play for 5 seasons. But there are some big lawsuits that are coming out, that are out, that are hanging over this as a little bit of a cloud before it really, you feel good that it's what's going to happen.
So I do think, though, and this is what I want to ask, my next question I want to ask you is, I feel like that this is in reality for right now, for this transitionary period, a seismic change from the standpoint that you had a whole lot of players who, you had players who basically kind of thought that they knew what their college end date was, like, and it's different now, and it's changed, and that's significant. And so it's significant on that end for, like, if you were a current junior who thought that you were heading into your second to last year, you're draft eligible, well, now you're heading into your third, if you hadn't redshirted already or anything like that, you're heading into you have 3 years counting this year coming up as eligibility. That's a different story. That's a different story when it comes to leverage as far as the draft. It's a different story as far as, oh, I really like college baseball. I'm not going to get drafted. I can stick around here another 2 years. But there's a flip side of that too, isn't there? That's like, if you're a college coach, you have constructed your roster based on the old rules. And now the paradigm has changed. And again, not that every single player who has 5 years of eligibility is going to exercise all 5 years, but some of them will. And those are players, and I say that from the standpoint of those players, but also for some, the high school players who are planning to join, they're planning to come in. Well, we already talk about how hard it is for 18-year-olds to compete against 21 and 22-year-olds on the level playing field. Now you're going to have a few more of those that you're basically battling for both playing time, but also roster spots, aren't you?
100%. And I think that the other thing that's important here is that there are a lot of coaches and scouts and agents who believe that this draft class, the 2026 draft class, is going to be impacted in a way that we may see more high school athletes sign with pro teams than we would in a normal year. And there are two forces at play that they believe are influencing that. One is simply what you just said. It is going to be harder and harder for the young player to find spots on these teams, because for coaches who, at the end of the day, their job is to go win. Like, they development, and here's a can of worms that I didn't intend to open today, but development is very important to colleges. Let's be clear. Winning is also very important to colleges.
It's more important than development.
The easiest, most proven way to win in today's world of college athletics, this is not a college baseball comment, this is true to everything at the moment, is to be older. Older players play better than younger players, even if their professional ceilings are dramatically different. Young player, potential superstar, is not always as effective as old player, has barely any professional future in this sport. So I do think that there are agents who are concerned that if you put your 18-year-old on one of these super-powered, old, expensive rosters, you are sacrificing, you know, real playing time for your athlete. So that's one thing. The second thing is the proposal from MLB is accelerating some of the fears that agents and their families and players and college coaches have, from what I've been able to gather. There are a number of people who I've talked to who have basically said, MLB threatening, even if it doesn't come true, MLB merely threatening high school eligibility as far as the draft goes may push some of these kids into signing right now, because they could be of the last groups of what would be a dying breed. Guys who are getting into baseball at, in some cases, 17, a lot of cases, 18, 19 years old, they could be the last of their kind. So I think that there are a lot of things at play right now between the changes to eligibility, how that influences roster construction at the college level, and then the opportunity to go be a very young person in professional baseball, maybe just being threatened to be eliminated, is going to be interesting for this year's draft. And I think that a lot of players and families need to decide, to your point, what route is best for them and how they're going to develop best. Because on their part, you know, as much as it is winning on the college side, for those guys, it's all about development. So it'll be interesting to see what they believe to be the best.
The other thing with that is that, again, when we go back to the uncertainty, the other part of this I want to ask you about is, so we're already talking about, we have gone from 11.7 to most teams don't, but you can have up to 34 scholarships now. But that also came with it, as we both sat at the meeting where this was discussed at the ABCA, a lengthy meeting a couple of years ago, where it was also talked about that, okay, well, that comes with it, roster limits. And last year was kind of a transitionary year. Where do roster limits stand now when you just literally were told, hey, everything that you thought you knew eligibility-wise has been changed?
So as of right now, the fact is that eligibility rules are staying the same. Roster limits are staying the same. 34 players, you can pay for as many of those guys on scholarship as your school can afford or wants to. There are schools, Arizona State, for example, is a 34 scholarship school. Wake Forest is way behind in scholarships. They're battling to be around 11.7. So there is a wide range
That's a gap. That's a massive chasm.
Correct. Basically, at Arizona State, all 34 players who play college baseball at Arizona State on their roster have their fair paid. They don't pay to go to school. At Wake Forest, the vast majority of the roster has to pay its way, or at least in part pay its way, to go to college. So yes, massive gap. I think that while 34 is the rule of today, the rule of June 30th, I do not think that that will be where it sticks, nor do I think that that's where coaches believe it will stick. 34 comes with a number of different challenges. The first is just purely a practical operational standpoint. And this is something that you and I heard at the meeting that you just referenced in, 2024. The 34-man limit makes it very difficult in fall ball to have team-on-team scrimmages, two full teams that will face each other and be able to play a full baseball game without mixing and matching and cutting innings and rolling innings and whatever you want to call it. That bothered a number of coaches. The other problem here is that with 5-to-play-5 now coming into effect, or almost certainly coming into effect, as has been adopted, is how we'll refer to it from now on, you are inviting an extra year of player to stick around in college sports. So in addition to having a 34-man cap, you're squeezing more players into the system with nowhere to go. Does that force the NCAA to expand the 34-man limit? According to a lot of coaches' beliefs, yes, it will. Does the NCAA always do what's best for the sport and to accommodate the amount of people that it needs to accommodate? If you ask every single coach, no, it does not always do that. So I think that it kind of remains to be seen. This could be, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this as somebody who's seen a lot of good baseball, what this could do to the Division II, to the lower major, to the JUCO ranks, because I do see a path where the NCAA does not increase from 34, and these players need somewhere to go. And I think that JUCOs and D2s and D3s are the immediate beneficiaries, and lower majors maybe, that wouldn't necessarily have access to some of these guys.
Okay. Point one that I'll point out. Where's we said? We're recording this. It's June 30th. We should be clear on this. This rule, as it currently stands for this 34, that, as we're saying, maybe adjusted, may not. We're not talking about a rule for January 15th. We're not talking about a rule for January 1st. We're talking about a rule that would come in place for the fall semester at all these schools. And so when they...
2027. The fall of 2027.
Yes. So, like, there's not that long ahead to make adjustments. And what I would say with all of this is, yes, because again, this rule, the five is, you know, we're talking about like, this is all like, all these things are being phased in. But what I'm saying is it's just another piece of what we've had now. I can't even come up with the power rankings of which high school recruiting class got the most screwed by all these changes, because I think there's a number of them that could make compelling arguments, right? That for all the, there's been a lot of great things that have happened in college baseball in the 2020s. Let's start there, right? So many things that felt like that they were never getting changed, or they were only changing at a very glacial pace. I will tell you, when I was, you know, I remember 11-7 for forever. I never talked to a college coach. I never talked to anyone whose dream was 34. The dream was 20. The dream was, can we get this moved up? It was not, oh, you will be able to fully fund scholarships for a full roster and depth on top of that. And that's where we are now. On the coach's side, it was forever. It's like, hey, we're trying to get the volunteer coach turned into a paid coach. And I will say again, the bad thing that they did, the misleading thing they did at that time, was they always said it's about improving the coach to student athlete ratio. And the real problem with that being is that anyone with two working brain cells could say, no, it improves the coach's ability to exist and survive. But if you take a volunteer coach and you pay them, that has not changed the ratio of student athlete to coach. It just means that the coach is better compensated. That said, that's been now that, you know, now I will tell you right now, college coaching staffs, in addition to support staffs and all, are at a level that would have made a coach, I feel like 10 years ago, look at this and go, this is amazing. We have all these things happening. But at the same time, the other part of this change is, you talked about it, which is, there are a lot of players, when you say like, I mean, yes, some of them are going to go to JUCO, and that could be great. But every scout, every coach, every JUCO coach I've talked to over the years has made the point, not everyone's cut out to play JUCO ball. Yep. Not everyone will stick with it. I mean, there are, if you see that someone went and played JUCO ball, you can pretty much not question that they love baseball and they want to do it, because it is tough a life. Grind. It's the cement block, you know, the cinder block life. And it is like, you're doing a level of participation in getting everything ready at a level that you don't have to in Division I baseball. Like, you know, dragging fields and things like that are much more a part of your life. Like, you're doing all of it. And for some kids, that could be something where it's like, this is a great opportunity. For others who have a different mindset, it very well could be something where, I thought I was going to a Power Four school. Now I'm here. I'm done, because I'm not willing to do this. This is not what I signed up for. D2, like, there's all this cascade effect. But the problem with all of this is that the grand scheme, the NCAA has spent a decade being reactive. And again, partly because they keep losing court cases, they keep losing lawsuits on us, but being reactive. And the trickle-down effect of that is that we haven't had, and again, I want to see what you think about this, but in my view, we haven't had this kind of level of stability to find a new normal. And the ones who do suffer the most are, like, again, if you're a high school recruit and you're not that elite, like, okay, I'm debating whether I'm going to turn down, you know, six figures in a bonus, or I'm going to go to, you know, on a full ride or close to a full ride and good NIL. Not that player, but the player who's kind of grinded their way out to get that offer at, you know, a D1, not a Power Four, but a D1 offer. And all of a sudden now they're being told, and not because the coach has deliberately tried to screw them or anything like that, but their coaches now that they are planning to go to is telling them, I don't know what, as it's right now. Because again, the other part of this that we haven't even gotten into is the portal's going on while we also have the draft still ahead, while we have this new eligibility rules being, you know, talked about and discussed and adopted. And so, and we don't, you know, and we have the roster rules. If you're a head coach at a college program right now, you are trying to put together a puzzle that is like that the puzzle pieces keep changing. And so like you may think it fits together now, and then because you don't know which players are going to get drafted, you don't know which players are going to sign. And you just talked about it also. We may have more high school players going in this class, but we also may have more juniors who were sitting here 3 months ago saying, being told like, look, I don't care if it's not the number you want. Your choices are either taking that or are you willing to take 50K next year as a senior sign? Well, you're not a senior sign next year now. You know, you're going to be someone who still has another year to go back to school. And also on top of that, to go back to your point about older players win you more games, you're going to have players, especially that second, third tier of potential draftee, prospective draftee, who it behooves a lot of these college programs to try to make it well worth their while to stick around. Because even if you're kind of a fringe draft prospect, a lot of those guys are guys who are absolutely going to help you win a ton of college baseball games if you get them to come back, because they are seasoned, they are proven, and you are, instead of you throwing someone in there that you don't know how they're going to respond, that you don't know how well they're going to be able to handle the job, you have someone you're like, nope, that's our Saturday starter. We're good. We're not worrying about as long as they stay healthy. What do you like? How much turmoil do you think is kind of going on right now as you see it?
I mean, a lot. And that's because the reality is that college coaches have always felt that this is a constantly shifting landscape, and that there really is no, you know, getting your feet under you to be able to have an understanding of what it is that you need to do. I think that there are coaches out there who have as good a handle on it as you can have, though. And I think that there are some guys who have proven that they are very good at navigating this era. I'll give you an example. I think that Wes Johnson's rosters have rolled with the times ever since he stepped foot in Athens. I mean, this past roster that went to the College World Series had over 20 Division I transfers on it and was one of the most, if not the most, transfer-heavy rosters at the high major level in the country, and they were excellent. So, like, has he, you know, molded to the rules as they've come and gone very effectively? Yeah, I would say that he would. I think that Jay Johnson, and I know that people will attempt to scoff at that because of the performance that they had in 2026, but Jay Johnson was one of the best coaches. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, Jay Johnson is one of the best coaches in the last two decades, if not even beyond that. So that is a team that has adopted the new roster rules very well and kind of rolled with the punches. I think Tennessee, and this is an interesting one because we're going to talk about them again in a second here, but Tennessee has also done an excellent job of this, and it is a credit to Tony Vitello. But if you recall last year with Alberto Ozuna, and it didn't even work in their favor when they had Alberto Ozuna with, you know, the Diego Pavia JUCO rules and whether or not he was going to be able to play, which ultimately never happened. But to me, that was a great sign of a coach having his feet under him and understanding some of the loopholes and the ways that you can build a roster and be competitive. And I know that a lot of fans look at that and they were like, oh, you know, here goes Tony again, or here goes Tennessee trying to do something crazy. Why wouldn't you? You know, the rules are the rules. And I think that for what your point being that there are a lot of coaches who may feel like they're kind of scrambling or trying to get their feet under them. For every one of those that exist, I think there's another coach that kind of lives for the chaos a little bit and has figured out a way to thrive in the fire, if you will. And they've found ways to be good. So, yeah, the NCAA needs a lot more clarity on everything. And it's been that way for, I mean, the last decade, if not even well beyond that. The NCAA has been a poor partner when it comes to best positioning coaches to succeed. I think that there are other organizations, the ABCA being chief among them, that have been what the NCAA should be, and they are kind of the voice for the coaches, and they are trying to establish some clarity. Like, every year, I think one of the most valuable things that we do, we being Baseball America, is we go out to ABCA and we just go and listen, because the reality is they do have a handle on it. And I think that that body of people, A, has a lot of influence to kind of clean up some of the muck, but B, I think that they have spent a lot of time and brain resource and brain power in trying to decipher some of the jarbled up rules and chaos that exists in college sports. And they really do a good job of laying it out for coaches. So yeah, listen, I think that there are a lot of examples of teams that are doing as best as they can as they continue to try and navigate this. And I know, because I've either seen them or talked to them about it, that there are coaches who have very extensive roster models that reflect past things, future potential changes, new eligibility rules, current transfer rules, future potential transfer rules, and they're baking in all of the possibilities into what they do, because I do think that that's kind of the only way to be successful nowadays, is that you are baking in all of the possible factors that the NCAA could throw at you, because they do change what feels like, and in some cases is, every week.
Okay, so we've talked about the landscape. Now we're going to talk into kind of what it means. We'll do that right after this quick break. So, Jacob, now let's talk about the nitty-gritty of what this means. You just said, like you said, we're going to a couple of teams, like Tennessee's one we're going to talk about. Which schools' portal moves stand out to you? We'll start with kind of the ones who are really have done a good job of kind of bringing in talent in your mind.
Let's start with Tennessee, just because I think Tennessee has done an outstanding job. I will also call back to a conversation that Peter Flaherty, shout out Peter, and I had on the podcast last year. When Tennessee hired Chuck Girolliman away from Florida, that was a massively consequential move because, and this has become Girolliman's reputation in the industry, he is one of the premier talent identifiers and collectors in the country. He's an expert recruiter. I think that part of recruiting in today's day and age is also how good you are at going to, whether it's, and I'm not saying Drolman has done either of these, you know, options, but I think that it's just important to mention to people. A good recruiter nowadays is also somebody who campaigns well for resources and make sure that their roster is in a position that can be improved, whether that's a conversation that an assistant, a recruiting coordinator is having with administration people, with boosters, with a head coach. And I think that regardless of what that path is, Girolliman at Florida and again at Tennessee now has proven to be extremely effective in the art of kind of bolstering the resources. He's really good at that. And it's reflected in their class. Excellent group of players. They have some draft eligible guys. It'll be interesting to see if they're going to beat the draft on guys like Jake McCoy. That's one where I think probably the draft wins. I think the numbers from what I've heard pretty high. It's seven figures for the former South Carolina lefty. But if he gets to campus, and depending on how fast he can get healthy, he had brace surgery, that's like a primo starter addition, somebody who could be the front of your rotation. They got Ricky Ojeda from UC Irvine. There are questions about whether or not he's a starter or a reliever long-term. At Irvine, it looked more like he was a reliever. The draft stock kind of backed up a little bit. Some of the release traits that got him towards our top 100 going into the year were just not the same in his draft season. Does he get to school? Maybe. But then there are a number of players who they've brought in who I think very highly of who are not draft eligible. Cal Baptist shortstop Chris Ramirez, one of the premier contact bats in the country. He is a monster when it comes to hitting pretty much anything, but velocity included, which is important in the SEC, in the zone. He is a sixth defender at shortstop at a minimum, despite being a little bit undersized. The arm is somewhat light, but he's a really good mover. He's got great feel for the game. That's like a classic leadoff hitter type addition for the Vols. Brody Trost-Claire from Northwestern State, left-hander, a little undersized, maybe a little light on kind of depth of arsenal, and he did have internal brace surgery. He should be ready for all of the 2027 season, or if not most of it. And the stuff is really good there. I'm interested to see what the step up from Northwestern State to the SEC looks like. That is a massive jump. That is a huge, huge jump for talent. And then a couple other guys that I like. Wyatt Hanoyan from Air Force was a All-American candidate for us. Braden Kiersey from Mercer, a two-way player. The reports from the summer have sounded like it's the real deal on the mound, and he can obviously hit for some real thump. And I think that they expect him to play both ways. That could be my number one class in the country, or at least maybe in that conversation right now. I think that LSU is the other team that's just...
I was going to say, is LSU the other one?
Yeah, LSU has to be the other one. Just they're sucking up top talent. They have their top two players in the portal are committed to them. Beano Waters, the outfielder from Notre Dame, and Landon Hood, the righty from Gonzaga. My guy, love Landon Hood. And then they've got some deeper, draft-eligible guys who are eligible this year. Cade Kurland, for example, is headed there. and some guys who are in next year's class. Dawson Park, shortstop from Texas State. Jason Walks, the outfielder from Tulane, who was very coveted across the country. And I think Diego Velasquez from USC is another one of those big ticket type players.
So, okay, I'll ask the question, though, to say, like you said, that for skeptics out there, well, LSU was big in the portal last year, as they are every year. Like, what do you think that they're doing differently at all from last year when it didn't work out?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that the addition of Landon Hood is like a real, that's a headliner type move. Anytime, and we've actually, this has been proven over the last couple of years just with how teams have performed in the postseason, teams that bring in the heaviest hitter pitching-wise in the transfer portal tends to really boost the overall roster construction. Like somebody who's going to be able to come in and in all likelihood be a weekend starter, that's a really big deal. And I think that Landon Hood is probably the best at that. We believe that. He's our top pitcher in the portal this year. And they have him. Beano Waters gives them a second headline name. And then beyond that, I do think that it's going to be a little different because of guys like Jason Walks, who is a toolsy outfielder from Tulane. I don't know that they bought necessarily the like household name star power that some of the guys who they got this year in Walks. Like Walks is a little bit more of a, it's more of an LSU player. He's a real prospect. There's tools there. It's not necessarily going to buy the college player necessarily. Like this is somebody who has a real future in front of him baseball wise. I think in Kurland, you add kind of the wily vet type who's going to be able to go and play the infield reliably. He's a second baseman all the way. He's shown over years now that he's a good player. Is he spectacular? No, but does he present kind of that unifying roster togetherness type leadership value? Yeah, I think he does. And I think the people at Florida would tell you the same thing. So it's a mixture of talent, of some really high upside guys. Beano Waters, I didn't even mention him. He's our number one player in the portal for a reason. He's outstanding. This is just a really good class and different from last year in that I think the higher end guys are a little bit more reliable than some of the names who they brought in this time last year.
Well, I think the most important thing we need to note there is that the higher end guys are just much higher end guys. Like last year, I'm looking at our portal rankings and LSU did the highest ranked player they brought in was the 30th in our class, right? Trent Carraway. This year, you're talking about the best player in the class, you know, top five. You're talking about multiple players.
The second
like that.
Best player in the class.
Yes, exactly. Whereas, okay. And if you said, like, okay, well, tell us what does that mean last year? Well, last year, number one was A.G. Gracia. Chris Akopian, number two, may recognize him. Carson Tinney, number three, may recognize him. Trey Beard, Joey Volchko, Jaron Avicula. Like, if you look at the top 10, Henry Ford, Will Gasparino, Garrett Wright, like the guys who were the top players in the portal last year are all almost without fail players who made massive impacts this year. So bringing in players like that, Jake Schaffner was number 12 on that list. Look at what he meant for North Carolina. You could just, LJ Mercurius was 16. Look at what he meant, you know, and he's got a ring now. Like there's a whole lot of players who it really did make a difference. It made an impact, but it also does trail off as you get further down the list. The higher impacts are generally from the players who are much more at the top of that list. That's what you're talking about, that LSU
guy. And last year, like you said, LSU's top ranked player on our portal rankings was Trent Carraway at 30. LSU has four players at this moment in the fold that check in above number 30 right now. And like I said, that includes number one, Beano Waters, number two, Landon Hood, number 26, Diego Velasquez, and number 28, Dawson Park. So this is a really high-end class. And as I'm sure this will not come as a surprise to people who've paid any attention to college baseball over the last decade, when Jay Johnson is unhappy with the results that he gets, Jay Johnson is going to go to the end of the earth to course correct and make sure that his roster is in a better spot. So we have seen kind of the crazy Jay Johnson come back a little bit this offseason and get his roster to a point where he feels like it's going to go and win. That is a scary dude to go compete with when he's feeling this way. And this roster kind of reflects that attitude, I think.
Okay. So now let's approach this the other way. Is there anyone that jumps out where it's like, oh, this has been rough. This is going to take some catching up for what's happened to them.
Yeah, I think that the number one, oh boy, like let's look out here, situation at the Power Four level right now is probably Wake Forest. That has gotten a little bit alarming. J.D. Stein, gone. He's going to South Carolina. Andrew Costello, South Carolina. Luke Costello, South Carolina. Blake Morningstar, who we expected to be the ace of staff at Wake Forest this past year, which did not work out, is going to Miami. Jackson Miller from Wake Forest going to Clemson. Jackson Roper still in the portal. Matt Conte in the portal. Like they have had some really deep departures. I think that USC is also in the same boat. We have seen a lot of talent. And as a matter of fact, I'll do you one better here. I will tell you exactly how many players from USC are in the portal right now because it is a staggering number. USC at the moment has, let's see, this is in real time, people. Southern Cal. Here we go. USC is looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 players from its 2026 roster, which was a super regional team. You want to talk about in trouble? 16 of major contributors from a super regional team are in the transfer portal. So that is a team that has a lot of work to do. I think that the resources that are available to them will be really tested right now. I think that we learned rather emphatically that Andy Stankiewicz has done amazing things for a program that was very much in the mud. Now he's having a hard time retaining his players because that's the business of college baseball. And unfortunately, you get punished for having good players if you can't afford to keep them. So how he's able to utilize the resources he has to put together another winning roster very quickly should be interesting because at the moment they're in a tough spot. So I would say that Wake Forest and Southern California are the two teams where it's like you really got picked apart from the Power Four level.
That's something we're going to watch. Obviously, we are tracking. The portal is closing, but as Jacob just laid out, it kind of is, it's a soft close.
Never ends. So
it never ends, but we'll be doing a lot more of that in the podcast and also at baseballamerica.com. But we do have one more topic we're going to cover before we wrap this up, which is we've seen guys like Cam Flukey, who we expect to hear his name called very early in the draft, also in the portal. We're going to talk about that right after this quick break. So, Jacob, why are we seeing guys like Cameron Flukey or Cam Johnson, guys who we expect to be drafted and drafted, in Flukey's case, in the first round, still putting their names in the portal before the portal closes?
I'm going to be harsh here. So the agents that hear this, I have lots of respect for you, but I do have to be honest. It's part leverage play. I think that there is a degree to which for some athletes, Cam Johnson is a primo example here. Cam Johnson did us a favor a day before recording this by entering the transfer portal, Cam Johnson being the left-hander from Oklahoma. Johnson's stock has plummeted over the course of the last several months. It started out in a pretty good spot before we started the year. First couple starts into the season, you and I were sitting here having a conversation, basically oohing and aahing about the transformed pitcher that Cam Johnson was. And then from then on, it was kind of a steady trot downhill, whether it was, you know, poor starts, the control really lapsed back to the problematic place that it was prior to this season. By the end of the year, he wasn't even trusted enough to throw really in the playoffs outside of having a no outs outing at Georgia Tech in the Atlanta Regional. Draft stock plummets. Enters the transfer portal as a, you know, late single digit, more likely double digit rounds type prospect at this point. He has now positioned himself to go make more money in school next year, maybe, than he would if somebody's going to let him slide and get cheap. I personally think that he will not be able to out-earn in NIL what he will earn from a pro team, especially after last season, because for all the reasons that I think his stock has come down, other teams will be wary of adding him and not really wanting to take on that massive developmental project at this point. But nonetheless, that is leverage. If you don't get drafted in a spot that you want to go, or you go to a team that's not going to pay you, you now have the ability to go to a new school, to a place that's going to allow you to be a starter, because we know Oklahoma's rotation next year. It's Cord Rager, Nick Wislosky, and Xander Mercurius. Done. That was settled in Omaha.
if it's your Omaha rotation and they all come back, you kind of feel like that they have a
position
on those jobs.
Yeah, I really like your chances. Maybe, you know, somebody beats somebody in the preseason, or they bring in a transfer who does something impressive. Maybe. But like JJ just said, if you're going to go and pitch those three guys in Omaha every time without breaking rotation, I have a pretty good feeling that that's going to be the group that we see in 2027. That leaves Cam Johnson on the outs. And as somebody who does need to go prove it for themselves, yeah, you want to enter the transfer portal. For guys like Cam Flukie, I don't even know. I actually really don't even know the motivation. I don't know how it there's no leverage created here, in my opinion, because if you're a team that's drafting this guy, at no point am I thinking, well, shoot, we got to go and compete with first round money against a college. Colleges are not paying first round money in NIL and baseball. They are in football, but they're not in baseball. I don't see the benefit. I think that maybe there's an element in his case specifically where it's like you go in the portal and he's do not contact tag, which effectively means that teams can't reach out to him. Do you do that and you go and you transfer to, you transfer to South Carolina because that's where Kevin Schnall is out of respect for Kevin Schnall? Fine. But is it anything more than an eyewash transfer and just kind of a quick headline over at Baseball America? No, that I don't think it is. And so I don't know if that's an agent-motivated decision. I don't know if that's just, you know, again, respect for Kevin Schnall. But it is it's eyewash. It's not a real transfer.
Okay. Could I play devil's advocate for just a second here? It is, how about this? It's almost assuredly eyewash. However, there's no harm in preparing for worst case scenarios, right? Which is, and again, I'm not speaking to Flukie's situation exactly, but I'm saying in a scenario like this, if you say there's a 99% chance that I'm going to sign and I'm going to get drafted, and I'm going to sign. But I would say if that's the case, it's 99%, but there is a scenario where, you know what, if I'm still sitting here and my name's not called by the end of the second round and the money I'm getting third round money, I'd rather go back to school, whatever it is, that you just have your 1% option or your 0.1% option the way you want it, which is in that case, well, I would want to be with Schnall at South Carolina. Okay. As you said, it doesn't really change anything, but at the same time, to kind of go back to that, what we just talked about, some of these other things, when it comes to rosters and resource allotment and all that, I can't imagine that there's any school right now that's looking like, okay, you know, South Carolina or anywhere, it's like, okay, we got to really move stuff around so we can make sure that we can afford Flukie, because as you said, he's going to be drafted. He's going to sign.
Yeah. It's just, listen, it's not, I think that to your point, like, yeah, is there some sort of safety net that exists here? But what are the odds? Like, if you had to put a percentage on it, because I'm actually asking you this, if you had to put a percentage on it, what percent chance is there that Cam Flukie is still on the board at pick 30?
1%. We don't know his medical. Okay. We don't know, like, the part that we don't know.
That's
the part we don't know. Like, if you'd have said, again, and he still went very high, but if you'd have said about Kumar Rocker, who was as accomplished a college pitcher as you could be in that at that time, and you said, hey, he's going to be still on the board at, you know, at 10, you would have said no chance. But again, it's like, oh, we didn't know the medical. So I would say that the medical with this, especially for, and I say this not because I have any insight into any medical issue for Cameron Flukie, but I'm saying he did have an issue last year that cost him time. And there's always that possibility. Again, I've lived through the Brady Aiken where it's like his medical was that his UCL was very small. Like, there's always these kind of uncertain things that can happen, but those are very small.
Yeah. And again, I think that, like, does the transfer portal materially do anything for him? No. I don't think that he's going to make more money in the draft. I don't think he's going to go in a better spot. I don't think that a team is going to look at that and have questions. Like, is it the truest break glass scenario of all truest break glass scenarios? Sure. But it's just that. Like, it's not. I think that there are guys.
Your point with, like, Cam Johnson is true, though. Like, there is a point where you are saying, like, look.
Oh, for sure.
I cannot, if you are at a point where you're like, I don't know if I'm going to get offered 300K or, hey, it's 150K, take it or leave it, or a mil or whatever. there are points where you want to have options because you don't want to be sure. at the end of the draft go, that didn't go the way I wanted, and where am I going to go?
We talked about Ricky Ojeda as far as Tennessee's class goes. Ricky Ojeda was a mid-major conference, undersized lefty that lacks power and velo, that doesn't really have a defined secondary pitch, that has not yet proven that he can handle being in a rotation, even in the Big West, which granted is a very good pitching league, but still, like, you, if you're a top draft prospect, you got to be able to start in the Big West. You're not, you know, getting max value as a leverage reliever in the Big West. It's just not happening. Does that guy go to school at a place like Tennessee because there's an opportunity to go and show that you can start and you're very young for the class? I think he's still 20 years old. Next year, he may have a year of eligibility again after next year because of the rules that are in play. It seems like a really smart, like, if I'm Ricky Ojeda's agent, I'm absolutely telling this guy to enter the transfer portal. Let's go see what opportunities are out there. Let's go see what kind of platform is out there for you to be, forget the money, like forget the NIL, forget all of that for a second. Just purely the opportunity to go pitch in the SEC is a massive platform for somebody who has put themselves in a position where it's like, you need to go do it. You need to go show teams that you can do it as a starter. You need to go show teams that you have a reliable secondary pitch. There are some like release trait things that I think he needs to kind of recoup and be able to prove to teams that he still has in the tank. What better place to go do that than at Tennessee, where you are facing the LSUs, the Beano Waters, and the Floridas with Brendan Lawson, and the Georgias with whatever, you know, litany of power hitters they're going to have next season? That's a great opportunity. I would even go as far as to say somebody like Jake McCoy. If I'm Jake McCoy's agent, I'm absolutely sitting down and going, listen, South Carolina's in a state of change. Let's jump into the portal. You got hurt. We did not have an opportunity in the regular season to show everybody. And granted, this was somebody, like you recall, at the beginning of the year, Jake McCoy was the helium name in this year's draft going into the season. He was the most popular player on the pre-draft riser board that we had. Doesn't throw a single pitch in the regular season in his draft year. Obviously, that will come with losses when it comes to your value. Do you go to a place like Tennessee, where, by the way, he will be compensated at Tennessee? Let me tell you, he will get paid handsomely to go play at Tennessee. Do you go do that and go show teams that you are the pitcher that they were ready to invest in? It's not the craziest idea. I think it depends on what you're going to get paid in the draft, but it's a great option to have.
The point I want to make with that, this probably may be a way to wrap it up. Not everyone, like, I don't want to use, you said, this is not an NCAA Division I quarterbacks where you literally, there are a number of quarterbacks who they could be drafted high and still do for the next year financially as well by going back to school, because the amount that they will make is like in just actual like tangible cash is more. However, that's not what we're talking about here. But at the same time, the balance has always been go pro, go to college, stay in college, go sign, you know, has always been, what is that number that you're willing to give up to stay in college or to go to college or to get closer to a degree, all these things. That teeter-totter of imbalance has gotten much closer because you do have these programs where they can legitimately, again, we're not talking, we've gone from the world of, are you okay, college, you know, college baseball, you're not even on a full ride, right? Like you're still paying out of pocket at a lot of schools. 10 years ago, you were making this decision. Now we're talking about no out of pocket and you're actually getting money in pocket. And yes, it may not be the same as the amount that you would get in a signing bonus, but in a lot of cases, it's like with the chance to raise your stock, maybe make more next year. And we just talked about now in next year, you may still have eligibility remaining after that. So you still have some leverage. There's going to be more of these discussions where the college, the allure of staying in college for another year is a much clearer argument now than it was 10 years ago. And yeah, you just laid it out that there are several of these players who, if this year did not go the way you want, it used to be that it's like, well, you just kind of have to accept that you're going to go later in the draft. And by the way, your best hope is you will make that money up 7 to 10 years from now, right? Like, because you're going to go out, you're going to get your bonus is going to be less. You're going to be in the minor leagues for the next few years. You're not going to make more money there because you performed. You're not going to make more money in year one in the majors because you performed. Maybe by year two because of performance bonuses and all that. But
you got to be great.
And you've got to be great to do that. Really, yeah. It's arbitration hits. And that's like year three, year four of Major League Baseball. It all makes more sense. But that's not the same thing we're talking about now. Now we're talking about if you can, again, in a lot of cases, if you can make six figures staying at a college program, and yes, you're turning down a larger bonus than what you're going to make, well, that's still a much more of a difficult decision, because also, as even my, you know, your ex alum, your ex, the players you're friends with who've gone on to play minor league baseball will tell you, you know, I really love college. College baseball is really fun. Minor league baseball got a lot of pluses to it, but it's not the same as playing in front of 10,000 in fill in the blank.
And I'll also just say, like, I think that we, and this is a study that you'll see at Baseball America at some point in the next couple of weeks. I think we're kind of in the era of max value for seniors as well. Like, I don't know that the punishment for going back to school, if you are a Cam Johnson or a Jake McCoy or a Ricky Ojeda or a number of these guys who have entered the portal as draft eligible players, I don't know that you're being punished the same way now as you would have 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago to be an older player in college, because we are learning quickly that some of these dudes are just really good. Like, Ruger Riojas is going to be a valuable early round pick, top three, fourth, if things go really poorly, round pick. Eric Nachtsheim is a guy who I've been obsessed with on this podcast since the beginning of the year. Eric Nachtsheim is a 6'4" career reliever who went back to McNeese State this year as a senior and pitched his brains out with a real fastball, draftable qualities. And there are teams that are talking about him in a really good position. Is he going to get less than somebody who's going to go, you know, in front of and directly behind him? Absolutely. Because that's the nature of the bonus system and being a senior. Mm-hmm. But is he going to get punished as much signing bonus wise in the range that he's going to go this year as he would have if he was in the exact same situation 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? I personally think he's in way better shape now than he was. And that is a byproduct of the state of baseball, the state of development in baseball, how some of these guys are capable of moving quickly and providing value fast. Like, that player has a real spot now in an organization that isn't viewed purely as fodder for a team in its minor league system. Like, I think that you can afford a little bit of the risk that comes with, do I go back to school? Do I play another season? And now, by the way, for all the guys that we just named, Flukey, even Johnson, McCoy, Ojeda, all these guys in theory have not one, but two more years of eligibility remaining. So these are all players who go back to school with that quote unquote leverage that players of old would not have had. Yep. So I think the transfer
portal, they're sophomores.
They're effectively
to use our paradigm that we've had. This is the draft. Everyone now who used to be, we think of as juniors, are now draft eligible sophomores.
And if you're Ricky Ojeda, and there are he's just a great example of this. There are a number of players who are like this. If you're Ricky Ojeda, not only are you effectively a sophomore because of the new rules, but you're the age of a sophomore as well. So if Ricky Ojeda goes back to college for a fourth season, he would have another year of eligibility left after that, as if he were a junior in 2027, and he will be junior aged at next year's draft. So all of the negative forces at play that sometimes work against guys that go back to school with a year of eligibility, he's old for the class. He's, you know, it's taken him 4 years. That all goes out the window for guys like that, because he's going to be 21 at the 2027 draft after, in theory, 4 years of school. And the only difference is now he'll have either done it or not in the SEC at Tennessee. So massive value if you're a player like that. And quite frankly, why would you not? Why would you not go take a chance on yourself if you believe that you can get better?
So that is the Baseball America College Podcast for June 30th, our last one of June. By the way, we are on our off-season schedule now. I know that this is coming out a little bit later on Tuesday. Bear with us. Like, generally it'll be we're still going to kind of try to stick to the Tuesday schedule, but it'll be every other week. So we will be back post draft, And I got to be honest, that one may also be a little bit later in the week because the draft runs through Sunday. And we're going to, you know, but we will review kind of what all of that means for college baseball, other things going on in college baseball. Probably also talk a little bit about, you know, some of the summer ball events and what's going on and players standing out. All of that in the next pod. And also, obviously, check out everything's going on at baseballamerica.com. For Jacob, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.